I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. This morning, our guest this hour spoke before the House Committee on Homeland Security. A hearing was held to examine the spread of Al-Qaeda abroad and also look at how the diversification of Islamist extremism affects our security. Seth Jones joining us momentarily. We have so much to talk about. Of course, Iraq has been very much in the news for the last couple weeks with Al-Qaeda-linked militants taking control of Fallujah and Ramadi. The violence in Iraq has included a wave of bombings today, killing at least 44 people. We'll also be looking at predictions for Afghanistan for 2014 because U.S. troops are preparing to leave by the end of the year. This figure really was extraordinary to me, that violence has killed 8,868 people last year, according to the Associated Press. 288 people died in that country just this month. Our guest this hour to assess the strength of Al-Qaeda, the branches of Al-Qaeda, and the future of Afghanistan and Iraq, for that matter, is Seth Jones, Associate Director of International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He's also an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University's School for Advanced International Studies. He served as the representative for the Commander, U.S. Special Operations Command, to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations, and also plans officer and advisor to the Commanding General of U.S. Operation Forces in Afghanistan. Specializes in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism with a focus on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Al-Qaeda. Has written a number of books, including Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda After 9/11, and In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of the hour, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Seth Jones, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Let's start with the hearing this morning. Did you hear anything that really caught your attention, or did you say anything that you think everybody ought to know?
Well, I think one thing that struck me with those of us who were witnesses, it was Senator Lieberman, former Congressman Jane Harman, General Jack Keane, and myself. There was unanimity across the board that the United States continues to be threatened from an expansive but also a decentralized militancy, Al-Qaeda-linked militancy, or at least inspired militancy, in multiple locations overseas, and that some efforts by pundits, some journalists, and some government officials to downplay that are potentially dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with news that has been coming out of Iraq, where we have read in the last few days that Al-Qaeda-linked militants took control of Fallujah and Ramadi, that forces fought so hard for. What is going on with Al-Qaeda in Iraq? Can you describe what that group is and how they seem to be creating such violence?
Sure. This is one of Al-Qaeda's five affiliates. This is, they call themselves now the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or the Islamic State of Iraq and in Syria, meaning that they have a much broader expanse than just Iraq. After the departure of U.S. military forces in 2011, Al-Qaeda was on the run a little bit in Iraq. It had lost much of its control of areas, especially in the west. There was a general resistance among Sunnis as well as Shia to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. What we've seen now is unhappiness, particularly among Sunnis in provinces like Al-Anbar, of the Maliki government, which is perceived as ineffective in key cities like Ramadi and Fallujah, in some camps viewed as too pro-Shia. And so Al-Qaeda has used those anti-government, anti-Iraq government sentiments to get back into parts of the country and to become involved in a much larger number of attacks across the country. That's what we're seeing. It's also taken advantage of violence across the region, including in Syria.
And is there some validity to the concerns that al-Maliki's government has been discriminatory towards Sunnis?
There certainly is some credence to the argument that Maliki's government has been discriminatory. The armed forces of his government tend to be predominantly Shia as opposed to Sunni. But again, this is, I think it's far too simplistic to call this a Sunni-Shia issue. It's more than just sectarianism. I would actually call it in the West unhappiness with governance in general, which is more than just sectarian. So I think this is there certainly is a sectarian dimension to this. Sunnis are unhappy with a Shia-dominated government and what they perceive as a Shia-dominated government. But there's also just general unhappiness with the quality of the government to provide basic services and establish law and order in key cities. And that's driven at least part of the unhappiness.
And what is the U.S. role right now? What are we doing in terms of supplying military equipment, advice to the government? What are we doing?
Well, the U.S. departed in 2011, most of its, all of its combat forces. It did leave a small Office of Security Cooperation in Iraq. It obviously continued to keep a number of diplomats and intelligence personnel in Iraq. But its role in training, advising, and assisting Iraqis has been very minimal, if not non-existent. So what the U.S. has said recently is it's acknowledged that the Maliki government has a problem from al-Qaeda in Iraq or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. It has promised to provide some weapons, Hellfire missiles, and some other lethal and non-lethal assistance to the government. But for the moment, that's about it. It has not argued that it's going to send forces back in any capacity, including in training. So, I mean, I think at the moment what we're talking about is diplomatic support to the Iraqi government, some intelligence support, and then a little bit more lethal assistance.
Mm-hmm. And is there a controversy about that? Do you think that's a wise policy, Seth?
Well, I think the answer in part depends on how competent the Iraqi government is in dealing with al-Qaeda. If you look at the news in the last week, there have been growing concerns about the Somali government's ability to control key parts of its territory, especially in the south, where there's a growing al-Shabaab problem. Shabaab was involved in the major attack in Nairobi at the end of last year at the Westgate Mall. U.S. just redeployed trainers for advice and training and assistance in Somalia. Now, I certainly think if the Iraqi government is not capable of taking back cities, particularly Fallujah right now, that it's worth thinking very hard about at least reinserting American trainers into Iraq. Again, they wouldn't be involved in fighting at all, wouldn't be a large ground presence, just a small number of trainers. It's something the U.S. does in a lot of different places, but obviously in this case would be politically controversial.
Uh-huh. If you were an American Marine or military who had fought in Fallujah or Ramadi, you must be heartsick to see the news this week, wouldn't you say? Doesn't it question what we did there, what we were doing there, how successful or what it appears to be seemingly unsuccessful we were?
Well, I don't think it should. I had a number of friends that fought in Iraq, Marines and Army forces, special operations forces, and then intelligence operatives that fought against al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Anbar in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this undermines what they did. This is a protracted war. The U.S. left in the middle of it. We should expect that territory over the course of time will go back and forth between the government and its enemy in this case, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate. So over the long run, I think al-Qaeda is going to lose in Iraq. And I think in the end, all the work that the U.S. Marine forces and other U.S. forces did in Iraq will end up not being done in vain.
Mm-hmm. There have been some news reports, as you well know, Seth, that the violence in Iraq poses dangers for those countries that border on Anbar, Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, the Jordanians so far have been very concerned about the spread of sectarian conflict and the movement of fighters into Jordan. Remember, it was a couple of years ago that they had multiple attacks in the capital, Amman. There are obviously concerns about continuing foreign fighters from Europe and the United States moving to Syria. Turkey has become a concern, and obviously a number of other areas, including Lebanon and the Sinai, just next to the Gaza Strip and Israel, of a movement of Salafi jihadist fighters. So this region at this point, more than just Iraq, is in the midst of some flux right now. And I think the addition of European and American jihadist fighters into the mix also calls to question, you know, what happens at some point down the road if they decide to either change theaters, come home, or conduct attacks against U.S. infrastructure over there.
I know you were asked, this is a big year for Afghanistan and for America and NATO in Afghanistan, with U.S. troops preparing to leave by the end of 2014. What are your predictions and your warnings concerning Afghanistan this year?
Well, Kathleen, I think most Americans are tired of war, and they should be. War is not something that you walk into casually. I also think that the in many of these instances, the almost axiomatic U.S. response is military as opposed to civilian or work by the Treasury Department or other organizations. But I would say in this situation, walking away from a country, Afghanistan, where there is perhaps the highest percentage of terrorist organizations, and I'm bringing in Pakistan here as well, including Kashmir, the highest percentage of terrorist organizations in the world, I think would be very risky from a U.S. national security establishment. We often talk about this as something either where the U.S. puts in large numbers of forces or it leaves. I do think there's a realistic option that the administration, the Obama administration, can take right now, which is to leave a much smaller number of forces to do training, advising, and assisting, to do limited amounts of strikes against really, really bad terrorists, and then essentially to have the Afghans do the vast majority of the fighting. And I think in the end that probably would be acceptable to most Americans, as long as it meant that we didn't have a lot of Americans coming home in coffins.
What about presidential elections? I know that you had advice for those elections. Actually, some money that we ought to give to make sure they run smoothly, but also a suggestion as to who the candidates should represent.
We have elections that are scheduled for April of 2014 in Afghanistan. President Karzai cannot, by the Constitution, run again. There is such a focus on individuals in Afghanistan, who the next president will be. My comment on several occasions has been that if you look at the way Afghanistan is structured, with its multiple tribes, sub-tribes, and clans, its ethnic groups from Uzbeks and Tajiks to Shia, Hazaras, and Pashtuns, is that actually the most important aspect of the elections is the need for these ethnic groups and tribal entities to come together before the election itself, during the campaign, and then afterwards, and at least embrace a way forward. Otherwise, what we'd see, I think, is a fracturing of the state. So my argument here is that the role of the U.S. here should be to support some sort of political consensus among the main ethnic groups and the minority populations.
And what are the chances of those ethnic groups coming together?
Well, I think right now virtually every major ticket involves both Pashtun candidates as well as either Uzbek or Tajik, or in some cases Hazara candidates. So I think the direction we're moving in is positive in that standpoint. But we'll see as we get closer to the election date, assuming this happens in April, where most of the key ethnic constituencies stand. But I would say so far there has been a lot of movement to cross, in a sense, political aisles in Afghanistan.
And I know that today you were asked, so one more question from me before we go to our audience, to assess the threat to the U.S. homeland from Islamist extremists. You said that some are saying that al-Qaeda was severely weakened. There's not a major threat to the United States. Others say that homegrown terrorists are still a threat to the United States. What is your assessment, Seth?
Well, Kathleen, I would say two things. One is the most significant threat in the U.S. homeland. It comes from two kinds of organizations. One is al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen, which has repeatedly and continues to be involved in plotting against the U.S. homeland. The second are the inspired individuals and networks like the Boston bombers that we saw last year, who were inspired by the al-Qaeda ideology and actually facilitated by using its propaganda, including how to make bombs, in building the bombs in Massachusetts that they used against the Boston bombers. And then you get, in addition to that, a number of other organizations overseas in Syria, in North Africa, and then in Afghanistan and Pakistan that are plotting attacks against U.S. embassies overseas, U.S. citizens, and then a few groups out of the North Caucasus and Central Asia that appear to be plotting attacks against the 2014 Sochi Olympics. So lots going on both overseas and in the U.S. homeland. It's easy to overstate the threat, but I also think there's a danger in some cases of understating it.
Do you worry about those Olympics?
Well, I think the Olympics themselves it's going to be very difficult for a terrorist to penetrate the Olympic Village and the sites. Mm-hmm. The Russians have shut down a lot of the vehicle traffic already. But it may be easier to get closer to the Olympics or conduct attacks within Russia that we've already seen over the past couple of weeks. By the biggest concern end up being a North Caucasus-based group and then one out of Uzbekistan, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, that have expressed both an intent and certainly have the capabilities to do it. But I think it's going to be tough to pull off within the actual Olympic Village.
Two phone calls for Seth, and we'll take them in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Seth Jones, Associate Director of International Security and Defense Policy at the RAND Corporation. He has studied counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, focusing on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and al-Qaeda, although you can see his knowledge is vast and it goes beyond those areas. He's the author of a number of books and just testified this morning, actually, before the Committee on Homeland Security, the U.S. House of Representatives, looking at the extremist threat to the U.S. homeland. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, use that if you'd like, the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Seth Jones, and we start with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. I think it's an important topic, and my perspective is a bit different than your guest, and I'd like his response to my question. Those of us who marched in the street, you know, down State Street here in Madison and all across the nation to warn against what we saw at the time as an idiotic ramp-up to war in Iraq, you know, we wondered, how do we keep marching in this drumbeat when we've seen our track record in past debacles? If we add up how much we've spent to get Iraq to this sorry state of affairs and just divide by the number of crumbling schools and homeless children and jobless Americans we have here at home, it's a pretty sad figure. You know, the Iraqis, they didn't have anything to do with the World Trade Center, and yet we use that excuse to torpedo our own economy and play soldier in their cities and choke and starve them with our devastating sanctions. And for what? You know, my own perspective is that as long as private weapons contractors can turn public tax money into a tidy profit, there's not going to be much of an incentive to stop wading into one debacle after another. I do not take away at all from the patriots who believe that they were fighting a war against al-Qaeda, but if al-Qaeda is more powerful after we destroyed the country of Iraq than it ever was before, and our hubris has certainly created homegrown and reinsurgencies all around the world, from here it looks like it's been a colossal waste. And given our shock and our track record, I just like the guest's perspective on what credibility we still retain on this issue.
Thanks, Carl. Seth?
That's a very important question. It's a good question, and it's an important perspective. And I think we need an important debate when we're using taxpayer dollars or considering using taxpayer dollars or U.S. citizens to get involved in conflicts overseas. I think we've learned lessons over the past 10 years, or at least we should have learned lessons. I did not support the war in Iraq or the decision to go into Iraq. I would say, however, that we are at, in Iraq, a situation and across the region where at this point we have to take the situation as it exists at this point. And as we saw in the late 1990s, as bin Laden targeted U.S. embassies in Africa, the USS Cole in Yemen, and then ultimately in New York City, Washington, D.C., and the plane that went down in Pennsylvania, the organizations that we're talking about here are organizations who, regardless of where we are, will continue to conduct attacks against governments in their regions that they consider to be oppressive, and Western supporters and Western governments, because their worldview, if you read the works of Ayman al-Zawahiri or Said Qutb or a range of others, is to establish an Islamic emirate in areas that they control. It's an extremist version. So we're dealing, I would say, with a small but extremist series of groups overseas. And I would just argue that we can't simply ignore them, in part because they have and they likely will target U.S. interests, as they have repeatedly done over the past several years. But I think we can do it in ways that are very different. I think we're at a stage right now where we can do two things. One is, this cannot be done with large numbers of American forces and large amounts of American money anymore. It hasn't worked, as I think Carl pointed out. And I think it's actually tended to radicalize people more than anything else. But where al-Qaeda has been pushed back, limited U.S. assistance, military, intelligence, organizations like the U.S. Department of Treasury to combat finances have been quite helpful. The second issue is, this is now about, and I think should be about, and should have been about at the beginning, helping local governments do it for themselves. And I think that's where we're at in several of these countries where we have extremist groups, is providing limited assistance to a range of these governments, including democratically elected ones in countries like Tunisia, to effectively combat, through a whole-of-government approach, militant extremists. I think that is well within our capability. It is much more limited than certainly what we saw in the early 2000s. And I would think it's a very important insurance policy to make sure we don't get a 9/11 again.
Seth, do we have an overall policy to get rid of al-Qaeda? Do we have – you just mentioned something that we should have and maybe have a little bit of, but we need more of. Do we have a counterterrorism policy?
The White House did put out a few years ago a counterterrorism strategy. I'm not sure I'd necessarily call it a strategy. There are several allies, particularly the British, which has a much more developed strategy, which they call contest, that involves not just what goes on within a country but also outside. And I would say that's probably something that's worth taking a closer look at, relooking a sort of a limited strategy that the U.S. has. And in particular, when it comes to the homeland, I think we're in a situation now where we have individuals like the Boston bombers a year ago that can access a range of information from the internet. I mean, militant groups are using virtually every major social media source, from Twitter and MySpace to YouTube and Facebook, to push out propaganda, to bring in money, to recruit fighters. And so in that sense, I think we've got an effort within our own communities, whether it's within Wisconsin or Minnesota. There's a notable Somali population in cities mm-hmm. like Minneapolis, to reach out to them to help secure our own border. So I think that's the direction we should be going. It probably is a little bit more aligned with the British approach.
Thank you, Carl, for your call. Michael in Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, hi. My question is that, why do we have always to think that we should control the outcome of the civil war in the Muslim world? Why don't we let them finish their civil wars, and after that, we deal with them according to our principles? This way, the way even the NBR always dealing about that you are encouraging to find ways how to win or to control the Muslim world. Why don't let them control themselves? Come out with their, the end, you know, like the outcome of their civil war, to build up their own states, and then we deal with them.
Well, that's a good question, Michael. I think the reality right now is that the United States in particular is a point where that is what's happening. The U.S. has pulled out of Iraq. Iraq is now involved in providing for its own security, although it actually has asked for U.S. Limited U.S. assistance. We're moving in a direction in Afghanistan where the U.S. footprint is coming down. And that's about it. I mean, there's very limited, if any, there's no major U.S. presence across North Africa, in the Persian Gulf, and in a number of other countries, Lebanon, Syria. So the vast majority of this fighting that's occurring, whether it's between the Yemeni government and al-Qaeda rebels or even Houthis in Somalia with al-Shabaab rebels, is all happening in those areas. The issue is, in a few cases, actually in a number of cases, those governments have reached out for help. They've asked the U.S. for assistance in radios or communication or other aspects. So I think there is, you know, this is not, again, this is not a zero-sum game where the U.S. either plays no role or it plays a deeply involved role in the fight. I think there are opportunities in some of them to provide assistance. And let's not forget the cases like Mali, where there was a growing threat from Islamic groups, extremist groups that were not popular within the government, that the French got involved with a very small presence, helped the Malian government push them out, and the French have now largely left. So, in that case, this wasn't even the Americans involved; this was the French, with limited assistance.
Seth, I'm having a hard time understanding the whole structure of al-Qaeda. In your testimony this morning, you talked about the core al-Qaeda, which is based in Pakistan. So my question is, do they run the show here? When you talked about the Islamic State of Iraq, are those people taking direction from al-Qaeda in Pakistan, or are they all autonomous al-Qaeda affiliates?
Kathleen, that's a good question. I would describe al-Qaeda in the sense of having four tiers right now. First would be the core that sits in Pakistan that's led by Ayman al-Zawahiri. The second are five affiliates. These are organizations whose leaders have sworn allegiance, they call it bayat, to the leadership in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And those are organizations that sit right now in Yemen, in Somalia, in Iraq, Syria, and then in North Africa, particularly in Algeria. Outside of that, you get a third tier of organizations that tend to be what you'd call Salafi jihadists. They are interested in establishing an extreme emirate. They do not recognize democracy. They're generally very violent towards non-Muslims, actually, including and as well as Shia. I mean, the Iraq contingent has been violent towards Shia, considering them infidels. And then a fourth, which are what you'd call the Inspired Network. So the core al-Qaeda in Pakistan has some influence over that second tier of formal affiliates that have pledged allegiance. But when you get to the third tier, sort of the allied Salafi jihadist groups, and then the Inspired, it has no control, almost no influence, other than what it puts out in terms of propaganda. So it really is a much more decentralized structure than existed when the September 11th attacks happened, for example.
And have we killed a lot of members of that core al-Qaeda group in Pakistan?
Yeah, the vast majority of the leadership in Pakistan has been either captured or killed. There are probably two things that are worth noting here. One is that many of them have also been replaced. So you don't win a struggle like this by trying to kill off the leadership, because if there's an incentive, there's a support base, and if there are grievances they can latch onto, they can recruit people and replace them. The second issue is they've also grown. So we've seen a notable growth in the number of these extremist Salafi jihadist groups in North Africa and then the Levant, kind of in the Syria-Lebanon area. So it's a very different structure. So again, a number of them have been targeted. you know, Bin Laden was killed. Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda right now, is probably the preeminent example of somebody who has neither been captured nor killed.
Thanks, Michael, for your call. We go to Rod next in Weyhauser. Hi, Rod.
Thank you, Kathleen, and your guest. I was just wondering, you know, 14 years now, but since them planes hit the towers, and I'm wondering if the straight goods came out, and if they went over my head, I didn't catch them or what. But here, the magic number of 18 Saudis, and you never hear people about Saudi Arabia, and here, Afghanistan, they went there. The general at that time said they had them in Operation Anaconda. Then we go into Iraq, but never nothing about Saudi Arabia. I'm just wondering what, you know, what's the deal? Were they the fall guys or what?
Okay. Thanks, Rod.
Rod, good question. With the Saudis, I think there are a few things where the Saudis fit in. One is a number of the hijackers, in fact, were Saudis, but the broader contingent of al-Qaeda was a mixture and continues to be a mixture of Salafi jihadists, of extremists from North Africa, from across the Persian Gulf, from South Asia and other areas, actually even some Americans and Europeans in places like Somalia. So Saudi Arabia has contributed some extremists to these to al-Qaeda and other groups. But I would say the other part of this is Saudi Arabia has also been a major target of al-Qaeda and a range of these groups. Beginning about 2003, there was a major increase in al-Qaeda violence, bombings in Riyadh and a number of other cities. There was an effort to overthrow the House of Saud by Bin Laden, based at that time out of Pakistan. So the Saudis have also been a major target. So if you fast forward to today, I would say there are some Saudis that are members of al-Qaeda. There are some wealthy donors from the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, that have provided some monetary assistance to extremist groups, including al-Qaeda. But the Saudi government in and of itself is generally a target of by al-Qaeda. And most of these Sunni extremist groups, because of its relationship with the West and also because of its unwillingness to establish the kind of Sharia law, Islamic law, that these groups are aiming to create.
When you talk, Seth, about the rise in jihadist groups, why in the world is that happening?
I would say we're seeing a rise in this for two reasons recently. We're seeing a notable growth since about 2011 in North Africa and the Levant, the area around Syria and Lebanon, among other places. And it appears that there are at least two major reasons for it. One is the Arab uprisings created significant instability in multiple countries. Even very positive developments in countries like Libya, the government today has limited control of areas outside of, the capital, Benghazi. When you get down into southern parts of Libya, and then even western along the neighboring borders, including with Algeria, the Libyan government has very limited control. And so the collapse of governance in a range of countries, Syria, we see active war, a very weak government. Yemen is a weak government, especially down around the Gulf of Aden. This weakness of government, caused in part by the Arab uprisings, has allowed some of these groups to come back in and establish sanctuaries. The other thing is we have seen a migration of fighters that have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and other theaters now, including Libya, actually transplant themselves and try to spread this in other countries. And that's what we saw, for example, in Mali. Fighters from Egypt and Libya moved down to Mali to try and spread this. So this combination, I think, of weak governments and these networks of fighters we're seeing across multiple countries has contributed to the spread of some of these groups. But I would point out that when you see public opinion polls in a number of these countries, there is very little popular support for the ideology of these groups. They're generally viewed as very, very extremist and very unpopular. They're essentially taking advantage of vacuums.
Hmm. We welcome more phone calls, and here's how you reach us. Our conversation is wide-ranging because when you look at the threat of Al-Qaeda, of extremism in the country, it takes in, you know, other countries in the world. Our guest this hour is an expert in all of these areas. He's written extensively, and he has studied counterterrorism and terrorism. Spoke, actually, this morning at a hearing before the Committee on Homeland Security for the U.S. House of Representatives on the extremist threat to U.S. homeland. Our conversation today prompted by the extraordinary violence in Iraq recently, which has been making a lot of news in this country, and the taking of Ramadi and Fallujah by groups that so many fought so hard and in many cases lost their lives to defend. So we're looking at the increase in numbers of people who are Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and also looking at Afghanistan, because our guest is an expert on that country as well, because this is the year we're supposed to leave that country. So what will happen there? And we're looking at other parts of the world that have seen an increase in groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Seth is Associate Director, International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation, also teaches at Johns Hopkins University Advanced International Studies. He specializes in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, and he is the author of books including Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda After 9/11, and In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. What do you make of all of this, particularly the news? Well, not particularly. We've covered a lot of territory here, but I'm interested in hearing from those of you who may have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. Are you hopeful that eventually we'll see promising developments in those countries? Are you deeply concerned about the violence that you've seen and the rise of Al-Qaeda in certain areas of Iraq? How do we fight terrorism? What about the threat of terrorism here in America? All of that is on the table this hour for Seth. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to go there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number for our discussion this hour is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. And let's go to Sam, our next caller in Milwaukee. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Hey, I just had a question about language. It seems like ever since 9/11, we have this word terrorist, and we apply it to so much, and it gets really confusing. And I just heard you say you were referring to the civil war in Iraq as terrorism. And to me, there's a big distinction to be made between those types of things. And I'd just like to have the guest's thoughts. Is there a distinction between these civil wars that are happening in Mali, Iraq, Syria, and terrorism, or do we want to be lumping them all together?
That's a good question, Sam. I would respond in two ways. One is when I'm using the term terrorist for these regions, I'm referring specifically to the Al-Qaeda organization, its affiliates, and the Salafi jihadist groups that are actually conducting terrorist acts. Second, when we talk about issues like Iraq, including the civil war, when I use the term terror, it is sort of the standard definition, at least in terrorism studies, which is it's a tool. It's the use of violence for political means. So in any given civil war, the groups will often use terrorism. It's against civilians. Even the bombings today that we saw in Iraq were terrorism. Most of them anyway, they were targeting markets and killing large numbers of civilians. So there's certainly an issue when terrorist is flung around that some people call, you know, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. I'm using a bit more of an academic definition when I use terrorism, that is groups or even the process of targeting civilians for political purposes. So when I use it in these kinds of countries, that's what I mean. And I do think there are ways you can group terrorism across multiple continents. I would also say that just because an organization uses terrorism, because states can obviously use terrorism as well, just because a group uses terrorism doesn't mean that in and of itself is a threat to the United States. There are plenty of terrorist activity that goes on. The U.S. should not, in my view anyway, get involved in any way.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Sam, your call. Ron Eau Claire. Hi, Ron.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering, and maybe this was covered earlier before I bought the show, but what ramifications do you see coming down with the NSA now that, you know, we pulled out of Afghanistan, we pulled out of Pakistan, and, you know, we've got inbred terrorists right in this country, and I guess I'm just wondering, what do you see anything? I mean, personally, I think he's a traitor, but I guess I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
Sure, Ron. First of all, on Edward Snowden, the conversation that has come about in the United States with the newspapers on the Hill, we heard it today in the testimony from members of both parties, both Republicans and Democrats, is an important discussion on this issue of surveillance and security and privacy. Unfortunately, Edward Snowden, in my view, did more than that. He provided information on U.S. activity overseas, what the United States was doing, how it was doing it, including overseas, information that has been a gold mine for adversaries. He's provided information on what allied nations have done, the Australians, the British. And I think in that sense, this has been very, very counterproductive and damaging to many of these governments. And it also impacts U.S. cooperation with them. But on this broader issue with NSA, I do think there is an important discussion on privacy and security that needs to happen in the United States. There continue to be a number of individuals, both homegrown and those connected overseas, that are inspired by, connected to the internet and the social media we talked about earlier in the program. There are criminal groups that are taking data. Any of us that have shopped at Target in the last couple of weeks, myself included, felt the brunt of that. My credit card information was taken by the criminal organization that affected over 100 million Americans. I think when it comes down to it, the biggest issue with this NSA monitoring and data will be what's called the metadata, and that is the bulk information that the government stores, not the substance of it, but sort of the phone numbers and very limited information that the government stores and actually has to go to a court to get access to the substance of it. That's where a lot of the decisions in front of the president are at right now. Should the government store this metadata? Should it be in the hands of an advisory group? Should it be in the hands of the private sector? Or, you know, obviously, should it be stored at all? So the metadata issue, which is so easy to collect now, and for anybody like myself, and I'm sure many listeners here who have ordered books on Amazon or gotten involved in the internet, any of these companies are collecting large amounts of information on us, and that's linked to the advertising that we're seeing very specifically. So this is the world we're living in. I do think the metadata ends up being one of the most crucial decisions now before the U.S. president. Mm.
Well, another crucial area here, and you would know this better than we would, but I'm wondering who actually knows this. We've spent billions of dollars on all of this. There are privacy concerns, and I guess the question can still be legitimately asked, have we thwarted terrorist attacks? Has it been worth this huge effort in human power and new building construction all over the place and lots of money? Has it helped us?
There have been a number of terrorist attacks thwarted. There have been terrorists that have been captured. One of the most acute examples was in 2009 when the FBI arrested an individual in Colorado named Najibullah Zazi and his two accomplices for what was eventually discovered as an al-Qaeda plot to attack the subway system in New York City with suicide bombs. That identification of Zazi and his cadre was in part a use of monitoring the emails he was sending back and forth as part of the program that emerged after the Snowden leaks. But there is still a broader question about how much is actually necessary and how much money and how much privacy is worth being, you know, what the trade-off is between security and privacy. So, again, it's one thing, I think, to say, as with the Zazi case, that plots have been foiled and individuals arrested. It's another to say that all of it is necessary in order to prevent some attacks from happening.
Yeah. Time for one, maybe two more phone calls for you, Seth. Bill in Oshkosh, hi.
Yeah, yes, sir. You've addressed this just now. Thank you for letting me be on. The question I have is, you know, the trade-offs, precisely. If we leave Afghanistan, there will be repercussions. If we stay, there definitely will be repercussions, all of them negative. How do we make that kind of decision, or at what level is it made?
Well, Bill, in my view, again, the situation, just to use your Afghan example, the situation is not a zero-sum black-white issue. I don't think that we can entirely leave. I have spent over a decade in that region, have talked with leaders from around that region, you know, the Russians, the Indians, Pakistanis, the Central Asian countries have all strongly worded a request to the United States to at least keep a minimal presence. I think that's where we're at right now, which is I think there'd be an extraordinary danger of leaving that region entirely because of the milieu of militant groups operating there, several of which have struck either the U.S. homeland directly or U.S. citizens in places like Mumbai. It would be al-Qaeda or Lashkar-e-Taiba in the case of Mumbai. Second, though, then I think what we're left with is a very minimal presence that involves limited training of Afghan forces, where the bulk of activity in countering these extremist groups, whether it's military, civilian efforts to improve governance, treasury efforts, is done by the local government. I think we're at a point where we really need to lean more on allies in these countries to do the vast majority of countering. And I think that puts us in a much better position. I think that's one that's a lot more acceptable to the American population in the end.
Hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for the call. It all takes a long time, doesn't it? It seems to many that it's just too long a time.
Well, I would just say that the most useful, or at least one possible example of this historically, is the Cold War, which was in part an ideological struggle between democracy and Marxism-Leninism. It started in the late 1940s and then ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union at the beginning of the 1990s, multiple decades. I think that's where we're at right now. And I think in the long run, these kinds of extremist groups, they're just not going to win over. They don't have popular support. This is a hijacking of Islam in general. And in the end, they will not succeed. But it may take several decades.
Seth, thank you so much. I know that you've done more than your share of speaking today, and we really appreciate your being with us for a good long discussion on this, which was very informative and helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Seth Jones, our guest, Associate Director of International Security and Defense Policy at the RAND Corporation, spoke this morning at a U.S. House of Representatives committee on Homeland Security, looking at the issue of the extremist threat to the U.S. homeland. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the show, and to KP as well for on-air production in Milwaukee. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be speaking with the author of The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of the Right and Left. our guest, a conservative journalist and essayist who's working at the intersection of public policy and political thought. So that's coming up tomorrow during our 1 o'clock hour. Stay tuned. Cyberbullying, how to counter it, and learning all about it, hour two.